Thank you all for coming to the Foreign Correspondents Club, particularly for a busy day in the, I guess, economic and financial news. We appreciate your coming. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times. I'll be your host today. Before I introduce our guest, a couple of housekeeping notes. First of all, please, everybody, put your phone on silent now or turn it off entirely. We do now record all of these events on video, so I'll be able to put it up on the website as well for people who weren't able to make it. And it's annoying for people if they can't hear the speakers because they've got, phones going off. Second of all, I'd like to mention our next speaker coming up, and that'll be Frank Lavin next Monday. Some of you may know him. He was the Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. He was the ambassador to Singapore. He's been in and out of government for many years, mainly serving in in politically appointed positions under Republican presidents, and he'll be speaking on U.S.-China relations in an era of Chinese ascendance. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Roy Prosterman is the Chairman Emeritus of Landesa and a two-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee. Landesa actually was known as the Rural Development Institute until January of this year, and they've changed their name after finding that lots and lots and lots of places have rural development institutes all over the world these days, and Landesa is a much more distinctive name. But this is the original Rural Development Institute that many of you probably have been hearing about since its creation in the 1960s. They've done a lot of pioneering work, particularly on rural land ownership issues and land tenure, and Mr. Prosterman has been a particular pioneer of that research in his work at the University of Washington. With that, I give you Mr. Prosterman.
Well, delighted to be here and delighted with your interest in the rural issue. I recall about 3 years ago, there was a spate of publicity in the media, thank you, that was to the effect that half of the world's population is now urban. 2008, half the world's population is urban, and quite a few stories appeared. I was struck by the fact that not a single story that I'm aware of appeared that said in the year 2008, half of the world's population is still rural. That's a fairly striking fact and tends to be ignored by a group, I suppose, of thought leaders, including NGOs, including the media, including political leaders, that are quite urban-centric in most of their interests. But China in particular offers a challenge for understanding the important dynamics of the rural sector. And when one speaks of the dynamics of the rural sector, it's hard to speak of it in meaningful ways unless you talk about the relationship that rural, usually rural majority, and in China it's probably still at least 55% rural, maybe some estimates are as high as 65% rural. The UNFAO says today that 63% of the economically active population in China is still rural. It's hard to talk about that rural majority without talking about their security on and relationship to the land, which is a major source of their income, their security, and their status. And we know globally that where farmers do have secure long-term land rights, there are a number of consequences. You list them in this slide. They invest in the land. You have to have a long-term horizon in order to make long-term investments, which are crucial to improve the productivity of basic crops and absolutely essential for most diversification into non-grain and other more valuable crops, fruit, vegetables, meat products, and so on. also for, as a consequence, increasing farm incomes, and as a further consequence, increasing consumption, and increasing land wealth. Some of you may be familiar with Hernando de Soto's work, the Peruvian economist who's talked about dead capital in the countryside of many countries and the importance of bringing that to life in the hands of farmers so that they will have realizable land wealth, very much an issue, all of these very much an issue in China. And greater rural stability. I think there was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago which gave a long-term perspective on so-called mass incidents in China. Well, the term that the article noted, the term covers everything from fairly small-scale stuff to things that are large riots with property destroyed and even people killed, that there were 10,000 such incidents in 1993. The most recent estimate for 2010 for China as a whole, urban and rural, is 180,000. So that's nearly 500 a day. And most of them take place in the countryside, out of sight and out of mind. And most of them involve land issues, the kinds of land issues that I'll be discussing today. One key feature of the Chinese countryside is its profound lagging behind the cities. The urban-rural per capita income disparity has grown steadily. You can see it from those two lines on the graph, with urban incomes now 3.25 times rural per capita incomes. And there are all sorts of other differences that are very important. Urban life expectancy in China is 12 years longer than rural life expectancy. Rural infant mortality, deaths of children in the first year of life, 2.4 times the urban infant mortality. It's still, for example, way lower than India or way, way lower than Pakistan. But the disparity within the country between urban infant mortality and rural infant mortality is very significant, indeed. Educational disparities are very substantial, much more likely that a bright young child in the city will get to go on to high school and then to college and university than that a comparably capable rural child will get to go on to those higher levels of education beyond the obligatory first 9 years, and maybe not even to those first 9 years either. The history of the land tenures, let me say something first, perhaps, because I know many of you have broad Asia-wide interests. There were four great land tenure reforms in Asia after World War II, all with profound significance for the economies and the societies where they took place. Japan, Douglas MacArthur, carried out a major land reform after the war, and it was a major factor in virtually obliterating what had been the growing influence of the Japanese Communist Party in the countryside. Instead, the farmers who received ownership of their land, they'd previously been tenant farmers, sharecroppers, they proceeded to vote en masse over the decades for the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan. There was a major land reform carried out in South Korea, which was actually one of the key reasons why there were never major behind-the-lines problems during the Korean War. And there was a major land reform carried out on Taiwan by Chiang Kai-shek after he fled the mainland and suddenly realized that one key reason why he had lost the mainland was that he never addressed the land-based grievances of the bulk of the rural poor, to whom Mao and the communists were very successfully appealing and successfully mobilizing. A very, very close track was kept of the output and results of the Taiwanese land reform in particular, and in the interesting, the decade after the land reform was carried out, Taiwanese farmers increased rice production by 60% and increased total farm income by 150%. You can see that we're talking there about an order of magnitude of improvements that if it could be repeated today in rural mainland China, would make a considerable dent in that 3.25-to-1 ratio that presently exists in favor of per capita urban incomes versus per capita rural incomes. But you can go closer to home, actually, on the mainland itself in the years immediately after the communists came to power. One of the first laws they adopted was a land reform law. And over the course of 1949-1950, they gave land ownership, private land ownership, to the great majority of rural Chinese farmers. And from 49 to 56, the mainland experienced a 70% increase in grain production, an 85% increase in farm incomes. Again, an order of magnitude which leads to hope that that big gap in incomes between the countryside and the city and the other things that are carried in its train can in fact be ameliorated. But of course on the mainland, they didn't stop with the private ownership. They regrettably went on to collectivize agriculture beginning in late 56, leading to the largest famine on the planet during the course of the 20th century, with an estimated 15 to 30 million incremental deaths from 1958 to 1962. They then geared back to a much smaller collective organization, essentially at the village level, but production recovered very, very slowly. By 1978, per capita grain production on the mainland was still lower than it had been in 1956, the last year of private ownership and private farming. Then in 78, building on an experiment that had been carried out in one county in Anhui, China became the first of the centrally planned economies to allow the breakup of its collective farms. And people headed for the exits en masse. From 1979 to 1984, practically the entire country decollectivized. We began doing our field work in China in 87 to persuade ourselves. We couldn't believe what we were hearing, so we went to see for ourselves that in fact they had effectively broken up the collective farms. And during that period of breakup, again, not surprisingly, on average, a 9% increase per year in grain production and 11% increase per year in farm incomes. But one problem with it was they didn't really give farmers security on the individual pieces of land that they received. Farmers, we were told again and again in our field interviewing, they were making all the annual improvements they could make in their farming. They were choosing seeds carefully, planting and harvesting at the right time, putting fertilizer on carefully and where it should be applied instead of dumping it in the center of the field, as had often happened on the collective, looking for weeds to come up and carefully pulling them out in contrast to ignoring them on the collective. It was very labor-intensive farming, almost horticulture, and it led to those significant increases in production and income. But what farmers were telling us, and of great interest, was that they couldn't make any long-term investments on the land. Why was that true? It was true because decollectivization had come accompanied by a pattern called readjustment, under which local cadres, in the name of population increase at the village or local, or at the village or household level, could take the land back and reallocate it in new patterns to ensure absolute per capita equality of each person's landholding. What might have assured absolute per capita equality, it also assured absolute insecurity on the land and made it virtually impossible for farmers to think of making long-term investments. So one major goal of land tenure reform was being lost. Well, the center became aware of this problem at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. In 93, they declared a 30-year policy. Farmers should have 30-year land rights, and that was not much implemented because it was just a recommendation, not a requirement. So finally, in 1998, they put in positive law a requirement that all Chinese farmers shall have 30-year rights to the land that they cultivate, and readjustment shall be made virtually impossible through processes and procedures. And farmers, moreover, should have a document confirming that they have 30-year land rights. So we began doing large-scale sample surveys in 17 provinces shortly after the adoption of that land management law. The shaded areas show where agriculture is carried on and its intensity in China. And you can see in the West, there's very little. I could have given you a map of the 17 provinces to find it's an almost complete overlay of those agriculturally prominent provinces. Those 17 provinces have 83% of the total agricultural population of the mainland. And our work actually since that time has been largely dedicated, in our China work, we work in many other countries, but China work has been largely dedicated to trying to figure out to what extent farmers' 30-year no readjustment rights are being honored and implemented in the countryside. And the most recent survey that we did was in the summer of 2010. And let me very briefly, because I know time is short and we want to be able to have questions, very briefly indicate what some of the highlights of the survey are. 71%, and by the way, I know there are a lot of numbers here. We'll put them up on, I think, on the Landesa website with a link so that if people want to get the numbers, they'll be able to get them. 71% of Chinese farmers, there are now two right-confirming documents, a contract and a certificate. 71% of Chinese farmers have one or the other or both. They're supposed to have both. Only 44% have both documents. 3 out of 10, 29% actually, have no document at all. Where you do have a document, you're much more likely to do precisely what the goal was, and that is to make long-term investments, particularly in the diversification of production. We ask farmers about 6 specific long-term investments. And the bottom line is that large numbers of farmers are now making those investments and are doing so notably where they've received their documentation, and particularly where that documentation is in good form and contains the specifics that it's supposed to contain. If you project to the whole rural population, and the survey results should be good to, as anyone says, plus or minus 2.3% at the 95% confidence level. You conclude that the incremental farm income, gross farm income, produced by those investments in the year 2009, which was the last full calendar year before the survey, that the total incremental income was the equivalent of $60 billion, dollars. And that in turn was equal to about 12% of total rural income in that year. So again, a confirmation that these tenure reforms can lay the groundwork for the kinds of eye-popping increases in productivity and income that could make a real dent in that urban-rural gap on the mainland. We also found that one out of eight farmers in the previous 3 years had made a market-type transfer for cash rent of some or all of their land rights. And the rent level was such, and up substantially from 2008 and up still more substantially from our 2005 survey, the rent level was such that if you were to capitalize that flow of rent at 5%, you would conclude there was an emerging land value of around $5,200 per acre, which is comparable to land values in fully developed agricultural land markets in other parts of Asia where there's similar pressure of population on land. If you were to project, now this is so far affecting only a small fraction of the Chinese rural sector, but if you were to project that kind of market land value over the full 300 million acres of arable land in China, you would see an emerging, potentially, an emerging land value. Remember the notion of bringing dead capital alive in farmers' hands, altogether of $1.5 trillion, with a T, $1.5 trillion in farmers' hands. I mean, they're just going back to that earlier list of reasons to carry out land tenure reform. There are just all sorts of reasons to do it, including investment, increased productivity, increased income. Those who report on business issues or are interested in them can imagine bringing to life a market of 700 million or so rural Chinese, adding that to the consumer market in the country. A lot of discussion in the last few weeks and months of the importance of increasing the internal consumer market within China. Well, that's the place where there's the most room to do it in the rural sector, with its 55 or 60% of China's population lagging terrifically on income and on consumption. And stability. If you want to cut back from the present, I'm sure, unacceptably high level of 180,000 mass incidents a year, most of them in the countryside, most of them land-related, certainly to improve the security and stability of farmers' land rights and their income with it is a crucial element of doing so. There are some negative findings in the survey. I'm not going to spend much time on them. You've probably all been familiar with articles on land takings for non-agricultural purposes. Interesting, the readjustment problem that underlay insecurity for so many years has now largely disappeared, receded in the background. But there are new insecurity problems in terms of taking farmers' land for non-agricultural purposes with poor process, poor procedure, and poor compensation. There's also an increasing tendency to take farmers' land for agricultural purposes and give it to big agribusiness or corporate farmers who, in developing country settings, and there's a great deal of global evidence to this effect, are almost always less productive and less efficient per acre than small farms are. And that's probably a good place to stop.
Before we continue, I'd like to invite up Mr. Yu Gao, who is the China Country Director for the for Landesa. This is at Landesa's suggestion. If you have very specific questions regarding China, maybe if Mr. Yu Gao can join Mr. Postman at the podium, then if you go around, in case there are any sort of very specific, for example, legal or other questions, then he might be able to answer. Why don't I ask one question as he's coming up, which is, if I understood you correctly, the capitalized value of land in China is now as much as $5,200 per acre, and you were saying that's comparable to industrialized countries in Asia, which I guess would mean places like Japan and South Korea?
No, I'm thinking more in terms of Indonesia.
Oh, Indonesia,
and
oh, okay.
So on. Yeah, it would be higher, I think.
Yeah. Oh,
but
okay.
Again, and it also depends on whether you take into account or not non-agricultural potential of land. This is a value essentially for land that's able to be used only for agriculture. If you were to, another interesting figure in terms of land takings for non-agricultural purposes, on average, a farmer receives about 1/15 of the compensation that's paid for such takings for non-agricultural purposes.
I'm sorry, 1/15, you were speaking to us, so I'm sorry.
In case you didn't hear. On average, the farmers who have land taken from them receive about 1/15 of the compensation that's paid by the developer to the village or the local cadre.
Okay, why don't I throw open the floor now for questions? And while some over here, we got one back in the corner here.
Hi, Ted Kavoris from Panoramic Consulting. So we obviously are all concerned about the disparity between urban dwelling and rural farmers, but what is the solution? I mean, how do you apply examples from Taiwan and smaller economies and spaces to the vastness of China? And also, I think the devil in the details is technology. That will always compensate in terms of a greater return on farming with less human requirements in terms of labor.
Well, one point to bear in mind is that in China, and again, it's not the whole geographical extent because most of the farming is done in the eastern 2/5 of the country. But there's been enough implementation already of essentially 40% or more of villages have implemented farmers' long-term land rights, and they're beginning to get very substantial payoffs in terms of farmer investment. There are about 50 million farm investments that have taken place in the last decade, more and more of them in recent years. So it's not stretching to think that on a larger scale, mainland China could repeat what happened in Japan, South Korea, and on Taiwan. But how is the question? And on that, we've made, and probably don't have time to deal with them in detail, but a number of recommendations as to further effective implementation of land rights that are already on the books. And most of the laws that are needed are in place. And as I say, probably 40% or more of villages have already had substantial implementation of those laws. But some of it's pretty simple, such as simply publicizing at the grassroots what farmers' land rights are. That was one of the keys to another big achievement a few years ago when the center decided that it was going to end farmers' taxes and fees nationwide. against the desire of the cadres and local officials, and it did it. Over a two-year period from 2005 to 2007, virtually all of those local taxes and fees went away. So the government, if they make it a high enough priority and really focus on it, the government can make that kind of program effective. It's partly a question of focus, and I think the media are likely to play an important role. If, for example, the mainland media or foreign media were to give more coverage to the importance of farmers' land rights and the possibility, the positive side, it can be done, they can be implemented. Here are examples of what happens when they are implemented. I mean, an average family making one of these long-term investments in land doubles their income. And that can happen within a very short period of time. So I admit I tend to be an optimist, but I really am optimistic about this possibility.
Okay. One thing I wish to add is, you know, for you to address the urban-rural gap, which is arguably, I think, the greatest challenge that China faces right now. For you to do that, there are different ways. And one traditional way is for you to, you know, give people, the poor people, the fish, and the other way is for you to, you know, give them the tools for them to fish by themselves. And to me, land, you know, reform, land policy improvement is very unique because it really promotes systematic change. You know, it's a whole set of things. And as Roy mentioned, you know, land is really the debt capital nowadays in China. There are many things you can do, but land holds one of the greatest potential, you know, next phase. And China now is also, you know, addressing the challenge in terms of further economic growth, which, you know, is again one major foundation for you to do poverty alleviation work. And people have been saying, you know, China's economic growth has been too much investment led. But, you know, in the rural countryside, there are huge potential in terms of unleashing the rural consumption, which is a gold mine that we haven't touched upon a lot. But land reform can really unleash, you know, those kind of potential. You would put opportunities and resources in farmers' hands so that they can make decisions, you know, by themselves what to invest. And, you know, if you give farmers the choices that, you know, gets into all sorts of improvement, be it education, health, you know, nutrition, all kinds of things, and, you know, gender equality.
Tara?
You talked a bit about what local cadres are not doing, and you also mentioned land being given off to large agribusinesses and corporates. How seriously is the central government then policing the laws or taking land reform, or are they adding to the selling off of land to these major corporations?
Yeah. Well, in that respect, there has been an increase of the trend, obviously. As we have seen in the survey. And from the legal side of it, we actually find that the legal framework is, you know, overall pretty comprehensive. It should be able to address the need. But in terms of the implementation, that's where the largest problem is. And if you ask me, I think the central government are pretty serious about, you know, the impact of all the wrongdoings, you know, that is happening, be it corporate farming, you know, big bosses coming from outside. As Roy mentioned, the trend is upwards, and you also see a lot of illegal use, you know, in the actual appliance. And at least one third of the land that, you know, that has gone into corporate lease are used for non-agricultural purpose, be it, you know, land development, commercial use. So, and you know, in China, arable land is a scarce resource, and the government has been trying to maintain the red line of 1.8 billion mu. That is, you know, the target. And it really, if this kind of trend is not under control, basically, in terms of food security, you will see greater problem. The central government is aware of this, and they have taken measures to address this. And for instance, in last year and this year, there has been a series of new regulations and policy being tabled, you know, to address the different kinds of phenomena. Not only arable land, but also in recent years, we have seen a lot of encroachment on the residential land that farmers have. And you know, in January, they have tabled the urban takings regulations, and now they are in serious plan and making actions also in terms of revising the land management law, which concerns the rural land takings. And we are pretty confident that most of the positive progress, you know, with regard to the urban takings regulation are going to be adapted into the rural land takings. And in terms of the attempts by the local officials to encroach on residential land, we have seen, you know, policy and regulations tabled by the central government to curb that. And actually, just a few days ago, September 19th, you know, I have seen news that, you know, the different central government authorities are looking into the problem of arable land, you know, the encroachment, different kinds of illegal practices here. So I would say the central government is pretty serious about that. It's more about enforcement, and also the publicity of rural land rights, so that the farmers know, you know, their rights are there, and if it is impeded, you know, they should redress that.
So, is there any way to quantify how much land is being taken for corporate or agribusiness use or development, the farmland? Is there any way to quantify it?
We don't have.
Yeah, I would say we've just completed another round of this 17 province survey, which asks additional questions on precisely that issue, among others. But I would say from the 2010 survey data, 24% of villages had at least one instance of land being largely involuntarily taken from farmers for agribusiness type enterprises. Generally not the majority of the land in the village. So we're probably still talking about something less than 8 or 10% of the arable land, probably considerably less than that. But the danger is it's the sort of thing which, if word spreads that you can get away with it, including getting away in particular with turning some of that agricultural land into commercial uses, totally illegally, it could catch on, and it could become a very big problem. But as Gao says, there are now responses beginning to appear from the center that indicate that there's considerable concern. I think there will be an effective clampdown on it, but it's an open door to something that could be very dangerous.
Just to follow up, and then I'll take a question, but on that 1/15th of the value of the land is the compensation provided to the farmer. While nobody would defend that, how much of the remaining, say, 14/15ths is actually going into, say, village or other coffers and being used for infrastructure? Because it's extraordinary the amount of roads and other infrastructure that you see in rural China now that you don't see in any other rural area of the developing country.
I think, and I'll see what you think, I think most of that is coming from other bespoke sources of income from the center of the provinces. That the takings income, well, for example, I mean, we, many, many occasions we ask farmers what happened to the income that got paid to the cadre or the local officials. Often it doesn't seem to be a matter of outright corruption. One common answer from the farmers is they ate it up, meaning basically that there was an orgy of banqueting night after night until it pretty much all disappeared. Another thing which we've observed fairly often is you'll have a rather poor village, but there's one really nice two-story brick structure, and it has air conditioning and heating, and that's the village headquarters. And parked outside are two brand new VWs, and those are the village chief's car and another senior cadre's car. So they're not formally diverting it to personal use, but in practice, I'm sure that that car gets used for more than village purposes.
Okay, over here, you first and then you.
Thank you. Actually, I have two pragmatic questions. The first one is, if I am a Chinese farmer and I want to get this 30-year land right, do I have to pay for that? And how much is it? Now, the second question following the first one is, if I work on this 30-year land right, if I have worked on it, for instance, for 3 to 5 years, and I want to leave, what do I do with my land right? Can I sell it? In other words, is there a market value for these land rights, or is it worth nothing?
You don't have to pay anything for these rights. I mean, that's one positive consequence of the original land reform. The land, technically the land, the rural land in farming is owned by the collective. The collective is defined now by the property law as consisting of all the individual members, who in turn are supposed to vote by a two-thirds majority for anything that significantly affects the collective land. The land transactions that take place involve use rights, technically usufructuary rights that farmers have for 30 years, by the way, now renewable under the property law. They have to define the arrangements for renewability a little more carefully. But it's the 30-year use rights can be assigned in their entirety. As if your neighbor wants to farm more land and you want to go to the city, you can work out a transaction. Actually, the law is very flexible and open in terms of transactions. Anything from one season's worth of those 30-year rights up to the full 30-year rights can be leased or assigned, and you can figure out what the terms and conditions. It's a real market-based economy. It's in that arena that the 2010 survey found that over the previous 3 years, 1 out of 8 farm families, about 12% of farm families, had engaged in market-type transactions, negotiated transactions, either with other villagers or with people from outside of the village for transfer of their land rights. And that's, again, the foundation for the calculation of an emerging overall value. But the actual effect so far has extended to perhaps 1/8 or with another year or so past, hopefully more than 1/8, maybe 1/5 by now.
I can see a bunch more hands. However, we do always have a practice of cutting off at 2. So why don't I ask all 3 of you to give your questions now, and then maybe you can try to wrap them together. But also, I would encourage people to come up and speak to our guest after we let everybody go at 2 o'clock. So maybe we can get all 3 of the questions together here, please.
Okay. It all has to do with education. If I'm not educated enough, I don't know how to claim my rights. One. How much, second, how much agriculture is there? Genetic.
Oh, farming. Genetically modified plants?
Farming, yeah.
Okay. And the next question, we're going to try to, I don't know how whether this can be possible, wrap these together, but we can get another question over here.
You told us that the central government is serious about the issue, but how much pressure will the local governments feel about this? Because they are a large amount of their revenue will come from the developers and other corporates. So.
And up here, please. Please introduce yourselves.
Hi, Abhik Bhattacharya from the Wall Street Journal. So across Asia, you see, because there are no property rights, land markets are relatively illiquid. So besides farmers resisting forcible takings or acquisitions, there are also disputes over what the value of the land itself is. But I just, but as I understand, your response to a previous question suggested that there are enough market transactions to ascertain a market value. Does that mean there are no disputes or concerns over what the value of a certain agricultural piece of land would be?
Okay, do you want to try to take some of those in summary? I know it's 2 o'clock and some people may need to go, but.
Well, on the first one, the legal education part of it, we recognize that as a crucial part of the change that needs to happen. And for your knowledge, actually, we operate 2 legal education and 8 centers in China, one in Nanning and the other in Chongqing. One of the major objectives for that is to do legal education, you know, work to the farmers so that they know about their rights. And it might be interesting, but the reality is, you know, in the rural countryside, farmers don't necessarily know what right they have. But our survey constantly, we have done 5 surveys so far, starting from 1999. And our figure has consistently found that in terms of legal awareness, you know, farmers are doing more and more better. And that relates to different kinds of things, you know, be it new technology, and also the general upward trend in terms of China on the awareness of, you know, people's rights. A lot of it, on the other side, has to do with, you know, the infringement of rights, which has been increasing as the urbanization process, you know, deepens. So, you know, to end, legal education part, you know, is crucial, and that's I think an area that I would recommend, you know, stakeholders and like-minded organization, you know, to look into further and spend resources in. And in terms of genetic, you know, modified food, I'm not an expert in this, so it's very hard for me to give an accurate picture on that. But it seems this is an area of increasing concern as people talk about, you know, food security, health issues more and more. And you know, the madam there asked a very crucial question. You know, in terms of the valuation, you know, system in China now. A lot of the local government's finance is based on land sales. That's, you know, the crucial, actually, I think, factor behind, you know, many of the difficulties, you know, we have been trying to address. But empirically speaking, all over the world, you know, there are different kinds of things you can do to address that. And for instance, regarding the rural land takings, we have seen, you know, different practices around the world, like in Taiwan province and South Korea, you know, Japan. They have been different attempts. And one interesting thing that Taiwan has taken on is to do, for instance, zone taking, which actually changed the scenario of all this land finance. For instance, in Taiwan, they made an interesting attempt. When the government do land taking, they leave 50% of the land in the hands of the farmers so that as the value of the land taken increases, farmers still retain a right to whatever profit annually that, you know, the local government will earn from that. And that's one interesting thing. I think, you know, in China, we could devise those kind of mechanisms that will change the overall scenario of the competing interests that, you know, the local government and farmers have nowadays.
Just a couple of final footnotes on 2 of the questions. On local revenue, I think the key is it doesn't have to be all or nothing, that there are and comparative law terms, there are successful models that may give the farmer 50 or 60% of the value of land for non-agricultural purposes, give to the local government the remaining portion of the incremental value. In terms of land market, it's interesting. We also work extensively in India with programs that involve acquiring land in small parcels, the government acquiring it at full market price for redistribution as house and garden plots. And not everywhere in the country, but in large areas of the country, there is a fairly active land market going. And also, interesting, in some cases, it can be made to function much better at the traditional land market in much of rural India. The banks won't come in to finance purchase money mortgages, so the buyer has to make installment payments. So instead of getting a lump sum payment, the seller has to wait perhaps for several years to be paid off over time, and only then he parts with possession immediately, but doesn't have a lump sum payment in hand, and parts with the title eventually when the last payment is made. The purchase program that's going on for these small plots involves 100% payment up front. So it actually improves the land market and is quite welcomed by those who would, for a variety of reasons, like to sell some or all of their land. It's going to take time for an effective land market to arise in rural China. And initially, it's going to be not assignment of the full 30-year rights in most cases. It's going to be short-term or increasingly medium-term leases, perhaps a 10-year lease or a 15-year lease, which is why I'm using a capitalized value. And eventually, and one of the findings, by the way, in terms of the long-term investments I described, is almost none of them have been bank-financed. They've almost, the cash portion has almost all been from the savings of the farmer making the investment. There's very little functioning rural banking system or credit available. And incidentally, at this point in China, the law says you can't mortgage, you can't use as collateral your rural land rights, your 30-year rights. That is something which is under continuing discussion and quite possibly will be modified, we think, over the coming several years.
Thank you both very much indeed. If some of you have questions, I encourage you to come up and ask them now, and we always try to give our guests something to remember the club by. Thank you all for coming. Hope to see you on Monday.